Paul McCartney said that his mother, who had been deceased for 14 years, came to him, appeared to him in a dream, and said something to the effect that "Let It Be," which inspired him to write the song, one of the most beautiful, most spiritual songs the Beatles ever put out. That's from March of 1970 when that was released, and always good to hear. We're talking with Brother Guy Consolmagno and Father Paul Mohler about their new book, "Would You Baptize an Extraterrestrial?" We're going to jump into questions about the Star of Bethlehem and what the Vatican may or may not know about ETs right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Gentlemen, I want to return to talking about Big Bang Theory for a couple of minutes, and how it fits together with scripture, with religious beliefs. Why does it need God in the picture at all? Guy, we'll start with you.
Well, the Big Bang doesn't need God within the picture because God isn't inside the picture. God is what allows the picture to exist. We use an image in the book. Paul thought of this first. You remember that game he used to play called Mousetrap, where there's this marvelous, intricate set of gizmos, and finally at the end of the game, one of the players gets to roll a marble and it bounces here and there and here and there and here and there, and the mousetrap comes down. If you think of the universe as a big contraption like that, as just a mechanical contraption, the temptation is to say, ah, God's the guy rolling the marble at the beginning. But no, it's one of the players who rolls the marble at the beginning. If that's your analogy of the universe, then God isn't the guy who rolls the marble. Guy's the God back at the Ideal Toy Company who invented the game.
Yeah,
You
I
know.
think another way to get at it, and this is more of a philosopher's way of talking about it, is a lot of people, I think, tend to think of God as if God is one being among others. The famous line from one writer is that, oh, God's like the giant flying spaghetti monster, just some really big, powerful thing that we don't really need to imagine. But no, speaking religiously, speaking from a faith perspective, God is not one being among other beings. God's not a cause among other causes. God is the ground of the whole thing. God is, in faith, why we think there is something rather than nothing, why we think the universe is ordered rather than disordered. And that is something science can't explain. Science has to presume order and has to presume existence before it can get off the ground at all.
I have trouble with this part of it. Big Bang is the current paradigm. It's the prevailing paradigm anyway, but there have been a lot of other ones before, and gigantic paradigm shifts. Scientists were so sure that they knew how things worked, and of course, we're not the center of the universe, and the universe does not revolve around us, and it's changed a bunch of times. This is the one we've got now, and I'll go along with it for a while, but I can never get my head around what was there before, when all the universe was compressed into one tiny ball. What was around that ball? If it wasn't space, what was it? Can you,
And
one of you guys help me with
no.
that? Well, thanks.
Yeah, no, but the idea is that in the Big Bang, space and time themselves are being created, are coming to be, if you will, are developing. So to ask what's outside that space is like asking if you're on the surface of the Earth, how do you, what's outside that surface? Well, you can't get outside the surface by going along the surface. You just keep going around in circles.
Have you ever read David Deutsch or any of the stuff about the multiverse? And do you have a take on it, either from a scientific or religious point of view, Guy?
Well, the multiverse and the various versions of it are theories that people have come up with to try to explain things they don't understand about how the universe works. And they say, well, maybe there are a zillion universes and we just happen to be in the one that allows us to be in. Maybe. In terms of the science, if you can show me a piece of data that is consistent with the multiverse and not consistent with there not being a multiverse, then I'd say that's interesting. But until then, it's as much pie in the sky as anything else I've heard. It might be true, it might not be true. We may not know. But what's really important to remember is to go back to what you said. The current understanding is just the current understanding. And if scientists thought we had all the answers, we'd be out of a job. So it's okay to say, I don't know, as long as you're willing to say, let's find out.
Well, it's like the point you make in the book about the little kid who kept asking one of you, I think it was you, Paul, kept asking you endless questions. Why is that? Why? And I've known little kids like that. I probably was a little kid like that. Makes me wonder, if we happen to be in a We happen to be in a universe that allows life to exist at all. I guess you could say, if you're a hardcore science guy, it's an accident, or we're the only one, or you guys might have a different take on that, Paul.
Yeah, I mean, one way to think of it is, in a universe that is this big, the chances are something as complex as life could arrive someplace. On the other hand, you have to think, wow, of all the possible universes that there could have been, as Guy was just saying, the universe didn't have to be the way it is. It could have been some other kind of universe in which the very possibility of life wouldn't be there chemically and physically. So yeah, there's the question of, you can think sort of hypothetically in terms of other possible universes and ask why this one rather than some other one. I don't want to come at that from a faith perspective and say, oh, that's going, you know, I'm going to explain that scientifically in terms of God. I will come at it from a faith perspective and say, well, I'm willing to receive the universe that we have, one that's hospitable to life. I'm willing to receive that and interpret it as a sign of God's love for us, as an expression of love.
Guy, I think you're jumping in.
Picture. Yeah. You know, whoever wrote Genesis 3,000 years ago looked at the universe the way they saw it. It was a big place. You could go all the way to the mountains and beyond, and there was this enormous dome of the sky overhead. And bigger than all of that was the God who created it, and that was as big as they can imagine. And our understanding of the universe grows. The universe looks to be really big, much bigger than we thought before. So now we've got planets going around. First we thought maybe the Earth, then maybe the Sun, then maybe the center of the galaxy. And continually bigger than that is the God who made it. Now, if you're going to tell me that there are multiverses, an infinite number of multiverses, bigger than that is the God who made it. I'm reminded of when you're a little kid and your dad is enormous. As you get older, you appreciate your parents as an adult the way you could never appreciate them as a kid. And if you're lucky, if you're able to see your parents, you might wind up loving them even more and appreciating them even more because you realize, oh my gosh, they grew up during the Depression or during the Vietnam War or whatever events that you didn't appreciate as a kid. The same way, the more we learn about the universe, the more we appreciate what it means to be the creator of the universe.
I've seen several statements from the Vatican in the last 10, 15 years. Under this Pope made one, his predecessors made them, different spokespeople for the Vatican about the possibility of ET life. In fact, other faiths have made similar statements, how we don't have any problem with it. It would just be a testament to the greater glory of God. It's not like this faith or that faith would freak out if there were confirmation of some kind of intelligence somewhere else. Am I overstating it or understating it, or is that pretty much how the Catholics and Jesuits see it? You would be okay with confirmed intelligent life somewhere else.
And I'm also okay if there isn't any.
Right.
It's an empirical question. I mean, if it's something we discover, then we got to deal with it and interpret it in light of God's love. But I don't think that we're in the business of saying ahead of time, and, you know, as if we somehow are swamis, that we know for sure that life exists elsewhere or not. That's something we'll discover, just like the Europeans discovered it when they came to the New World. Well, that was a big surprise for them to deal with, and they had to adjust their theological vision.
Do you think the Vatican makes these statements, or these pop up from time to time, just because people are interested in the possibility of ET life, so they pepper different people like you with those kind of questions?
That's really what happens to us, yeah. You know, Paul, as a philosopher of science, has taught me the idea of a critical experiment. You make the experiment, and then you've learned something. It's this way or that way. Well, finding ET is not a critical experiment, because anyone you ask, whether they're an atheist or belong to this religion or that religion or the other religion, they all say, if we find ET, that would confirm what I've always believed. And the fact
right.
that we haven't found ET yet hasn't dissuaded them from believing what they believe. So, you know, it's not going to be a critical change. There was a philosopher of science years ago, I think it might have been Michael Crow, but I'm not sure, who made a point I thought was fascinating. He said, we've already incorporated into our own view of the universe the idea that there could be other intelligences. And it wouldn't be the shock. It would be sort of like, yeah, kind of. I knew that all along. The real shock has been, to my mind, that we haven't seen them yet.
You know, when we cover a lot of exotic topics on this program, as you probably know, ETs and UFOs and things like that. And I've always been interested in it, or at least for the past 25 years. When I first started doing TV news reports about these topics and some research that had been done into it, I got a letter from a guy at the Vatican who said, "Hey, could you send me a copy of your stories?" And I've still got the letter. I'll even share it with you. I don't want to get him in trouble or something. But he said, "We have an ongoing interest in this. Could you send me a copy of these stories?" It was Father Thomas, I think his name was. And he said, "And I'll show it to higher ups that we have a kind of an interest in." I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. So I've always watched as different bits and pieces and little tiny statements come out of anybody associated with the Vatican and assumed, oh, there must be some kind of a room full of stuff.
If there
I'm
is,
wrong,
I
though.
Haven't seen it.
Is there such a thing as like a Vatican security clearance where you guys are not high enough up?
The thing
not, not that I know
Vatican. Of. Yeah. The thing you got to remember about the Vatican, yeah, we're a church of 1.2 billion people, and the folks at the Vatican who are trying to keep control of the bureaucracy number about 500. It's actually a pretty small outfit. And what's more, we're people just like everyone else, and some people are mad about football, and some people are mad about UFOs, and some people are mad about pop music, because we're people, and we share the same interests as anyone else. But there's very little in the sense of you know, organize this or organize that. To paraphrase the fellow who said this about the Democratic Party one time, you know, "I don't believe in an organized religion. I'm a Catholic."
There was a conference back in August that NASA held. Some NASA scientists, the NASA historian, organized this thing, and he gave a quote about it. He said why they wanted to explore the possibility of ET life is the idea, quote, this is historian Stephen Dick, he said, "The idea is not to wait until we make a discovery, but to try and prepare the public for what the implications might be when such a discovery is made." Is there a need for the church to get out in front of this thing? I guess the answer would be no. You're already ready for it.
Well, I was actually part of that conference.
Oh.
Yeah, Stephen Dick invited me. I gave a little paper about it and, you know, the ethical implications. The fact is we don't have the ETs, so the questions that we explore are not about ET, but about us. We're really asking, what does it mean to us that there could be other intelligences? What does it mean to us in our sense of religion? You know, when we ask the question, would you baptize an ET? I can't tell you about the ET because I have no data, but I can tell you about baptism. Oh, well, how do I understand baptism once I recognize that there might be other creatures who are in a relationship with God and maybe in need of, you know, curing the fact that they make mistakes too? It allows you to look at the big ethical questions from a new perspective. It's like reading science fiction. At the end of the day, you know it's fiction, but if it's a good story, it's told you some truth that you wouldn't have thought of otherwise.
I see a quote that's from you in this same article, and it says, any entity, no matter how many tentacles it has a soul. I can see all kinds of ways that that could be turned into a really nasty headline for you.
And it has.
Has it, really?
Oh, yeah. The title of the book comes from an event that occurred in 2010 in Birmingham, England. I was there at the Birmingham Science Festival, and it's this thing to publicize science and get people interested in science. And they said, "Oh, could you do an interview with the papers to publicize the festival?" So there I am in Birmingham on like the 20th of September, which just happens to be the day that Pope Benedict is also in Birmingham, England.
Uh-oh.
So the reporters are trying to get me to say something embarrassing about the Pope, and I don't have anything embarrassing to say about the Pope. I thought he was a pretty good guy. So they're not getting the story they want. Finally, one of them, trying to get me into a gotcha corner, goes, "So would you baptize an extraterrestrial?" And I look at him funny and go, "Yeah, only if she asks, right? In other words, you show me the extraterrestrial and then we can talk." They got a good laugh out of it, which is what I meant. But the next day, they ran that as their headline story, you know, "Vatican astronomer said he would baptize ET," which I'm saying, it's a science fiction question, and it's a fun question. But like all of these questions, pondering the question is much more important than coming up with a pat answer in the back of the book.
So, As in faith, also in science, a lot happens hypothetically. There was another conference last spring, which one of our Jesuits at the observatory helped organize, on astrobiology. It's a whole new field coming to be where scientists talk about what kind of life could possibly exist on the new planets that are being discovered far away. And again, the whole point of that field is not that they've discovered life, but they're trying to think scientifically, hypothetically, what would it be like, so that they're ready to deal with it if it's discovered someday. Happens in science, happens in faith.
I'm looking at one of the headlines, Guy. I'd love to baptize ET, says Vatican stargazer. You didn't just say you would do it. You said you'd love to do it.
There might have been a little bit of journalistic exaggeration there. But, hey, I used to be a journalist. I know how hard it is, so I'll give them a break.
I want to talk about Star Bethlehem, but I think we're going to a break here in like 2 minutes, so probably not enough time. Back to the title. I'm sorry, how much? We got 4 minutes. Let's go back to the title of the book, Would You Baptize an Extraterrestrial? I mean, it's a great title for a book, and it'll grab the attention of people. But there's all kinds of answers to this. There's actually more questions than answers that go along with that central query. For example, you know, would an ET want to be baptized? That's a central question to have to ask.
Well, if there are other planets, if there are planets that can house life, if that life develops to what we would recognize as intelligent, if that life is in some kind of relationship with God, if that life can communicate to us, then it's an interesting question. We got something to talk about. But any one of those chain of ifs goes wrong, and we'll never know. So precisely, it's the kind of question that you don't... Look, there are some questions in life like, you know, do I have enough money in my pocket to buy a candy bar? Once you know the answer, the question's boring. There are other questions that you'll ask the rest of your life, like, what kind of candy bar do I want to buy? Why do I love chocolate? You know, what is the deeper meaning of the rush I get from sugar? I'm being silly here, but I'm trying to illustrate that the question about baptizing an ET is a question you ponder in your heart. It's not a question that you come down with a pat answer and then put it aside saying, oop, got that one solved.
Well, you could also look at it from this perspective. If ET came here and arrived on this planet, its technology would be far superior to ours. Maybe it's an older civilization. Chances are pretty good ET would want to baptize you as opposed to the other way around.
Well, you think that more technology is going to make us better people, and then look at the wars of World War, you know, of the 20th century. Just because you've got more technology doesn't mean you've got a higher set of ethics or you've got the answers to all the great questions of life.
No, but you might think you do.
Yeah, certainly you might think you do. You can look backwards as well as forwards. Look back to the European exploration of the New World. What happened so often was the question of baptism for the indigenous peoples was less about those people and more about politics and disputes in Europe. I think the big challenge, meeting ET, meeting anyone else, is to keep in mind the why behind baptism and not make it be about us and our issues. It should be about ET and about God's love.
You know, your church has been pretty hard on free thinkers, guys like you. Men just like the two of you have been pretty tough. Galileo comes to mind. You mentioned kind of the circumstances surrounding what happened to Galileo and Giordano Bruno. The church obviously has changed since those days, since you guys are here talking about this.
But the whole Galileo point out the church was hard on just a small number of very famous free thinkers. And it's those bad exceptions that have kind of made the history. But I think that wasn't the rule. Guy, I'm sorry I interrupted you.
Yeah, no, I'm basically saying the same thing, that the whole Galileo story is a lot more complicated than the myth. But the truth doesn't make the church look any better.
We're going to take a break. We'll come back. I want to get into the Star of Bethlehem, maybe ask you about Mars and the new evidence found on Mars and what it might mean. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. U2 and B.B. King just tearing it up from 1989 when Love Comes to Town. Some biblical references in there. We're talking with Brother Guy and Father Paul about their new book, Would You Baptize an Extraterrestrial? They have a unique take on the search for the Star of Bethlehem, trying to find an astronomical explanation for what was reported in the Bible. We'll get into that right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. In your new book, Would You Baptize an Extraterrestrial? The two of you make a case for searching for the Star of Bethlehem. And you make a point that, you know, you can get computer software, you can figure out what the date is or approximate date of when Jesus was born, figure out what astronomical event might explain what the Magi were doing. Guy, maybe we start with you. I guess the first problem is figuring out what date actually works, right?
Well, the real problem that we get to at the end is you can find lots of things because the date is pretty loose. There's about a 10-year window when it might have happened. And there are lots of fascinating things that occur in the sky during that time. At the end of the day, you never know if any of them were the thing that Matthew was actually writing about in the gospel. So it's a fun exercise, but I don't put a whole lot of deep significance in identifying it as this event or that event.
Paul, have you studied Jesus sort of as an historical figure apart from Scripture or together with Scripture as a real man?
Sure, of course. That'd be a typical part of theological study in the formation of a priest is you do a historical critical study along with, you know, what you'd call more properly, I don't know, pastoral theological study.
You think you know when he was born?
An exact date? No idea. I don't think there's no idea. I mean, you can, as Guy says, you can do it with about a 10-year window, but there's not the sources available to independently confirm that.
There was a line in the book I remember that struck me. I don't know which one of you said it in your dialogues, but that the Magi are sort of an inspiration to Jesuits. Maybe that was you, Guy.
No, it was actually Paul. I'll let him do a riff on that.
Something I said, Guy picked up on it. Yeah, if the Magi are people who are willing to put their lives on the line to follow the star, to follow up on what they're seeing scientifically using their reason, and these guys go on the road, they take a big risk. I think that's part of the glory of pursuing science is being able to, you know, scientists put their lives on the line in a sense. It's a vocation. They put a lot of things on hold in their lives, and as Brother Guy has done, they travel to strange places to pursue their science. And I think that that's a model for us Jesuits, in the sense that Jesuits have, from the start, traveled the world, putting in service of the faith, but also using science in dialogue with faith and putting their lives on the line. So,
we had a go ahead.
If I can go on, that whole sense of traveling, I think, is really important. We've got these space probes that are Pioneer or Voyager. The idea that the space probes represent a voyage. We're sending space probes to other places to look for things. We ourselves tell our lives as a story of a voyage. You know, some of the great literature. The movie The Hobbit, what's the subtitle of The Hobbit? There and Back Again. The idea of a voyage, the idea of getting out of your house, getting out of your room, going and looking at the universe. It's a big universe out there, you know, let's go look at it. But the other half of the story, and this is also in the Magi story, is then you go home. Then you send the data back. Then it's back again. And you go home changed. You go home a different person from who you were when you went out. In the story of the Magi, we have both this wonderful metaphor for human life, and we may very well also be having a description of, you know, a bunch of guys who actually did do the traveling. So it's wonderful. I think it can be a metaphor and also be literally true.
We had some news a couple of days ago from Mars, from probes on Mars, about evidence of methane. NASA was kind of excited. Is that the kind of a story that would sort of reverberate through the Vatican astronomy? Hey, that's pretty interesting. Or does it really not matter that much?
It reverberated through my field because I'm the planetary scientist. I know the guys, you know, who are built the equipment and who have been arguing about it back and forth. The exciting thing isn't that they found the methane, but that the methane goes away really fast. And that's the part we don't understand. I think it was Isaac Asimov years ago who said the most exciting thing to hear in a lab is not Eureka, but rather to somebody saying, that's funny. Because it's the little things that suddenly make you realize you don't have all the answers that finally wake you up and lead you on voyages. So I'm sure, you know, if there were Magi looking at the stars, they would have come up with an astronomical or an astrological something. look at it, scratch their head, and go, that's funny. I wonder where this is going to lead us.
Help me understand it. I don't want to dwell on this too much, but what is the significance of the methane going away? Does that make it more likely that it's an organic source or a chemical source, or what does it mean?
Well, it means it's local, whatever it is. It's something going on near the surface of Mars. And the easiest, but not the only way to do that is if there would be some kind of bug below the surface. So it's an interesting bit of smoke, but you don't always know if there's fire where there's smoke.
Seems like NASA has sent so many probes up there that didn't have the capability to search for actual evidence of life. It's like they didn't want to really know.
No, it's that you don't know what you're looking for yet. The first probe that they sent, the Viking probe, had instruments that were, by golly, going to look for life. But the trouble is, when you build an instrument, you're making assumptions about what you're looking for. And it turns out Mars is a lot more complicated and would do things that would foul up those instruments in a way we never knew, because we'd never been to Mars before. That's an important issue in science or religion, that if you think you know ahead of time what the answer is going to be, you always are tempted to jump to that answer rather than to stand back and to say, maybe there's something more going on.
So what sort of goes back. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Sort of goes back to compare it to SETI, you know, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, looking for radio waves, assuming that there's radio waves out there.
And now we find out that on Earth we don't even use those kind of radio waves anymore. You know, it's digital.
You also have a chapter that was a lot of fun in the book about poor Pluto. And Guy, I guess you were one of the guys who was in on shuttling poor Pluto off to the nether regions of the cosmos or the solar system.
No, not the nether regions. When Pluto thought it was a planet, it was an ugly duckling of a planet. It had the wrong size and the wrong orbit, and all the other planets laughed at it. But then it discovered it was a member of a completely different family of objects, where it fits right in, and it's a beautiful swan instead of the ugly duckling.
That's a big fish in a smaller pond.
Something like that, yeah.
But the lesson being that it's all in how you look at it, and it's a different perspective gives you a better chance of getting some answers.
Yeah, in science, you're always imposing, in some sense, you have to impose your own categories, and you hope the categories you have match the way the world is. And that's part of the progress of science is, how do we divvy up the world, as some philosophers say, how do we cut nature at the joints and have the right kinds of categories to reveal the world the way it really is? And that's what they did in the case of Pluto. They said, you know, it doesn't really reveal the reality of the solar system if we keep including Pluto as one of the planets instead of lumping it together in this other category of dwarf planets.
You still have passionate Pluto defenders out there who will argue all day about this, won't they?
They do, and it's people who are afraid of change, the people who are looking for science to have the answer, when the whole joy of science is that it doesn't have the answer. It's rather that we have this wonderful conversation where the words keep changing as we understand the words better. So the word planet now has a slightly different meaning than it did 100 years ago or even 20 years ago. And that's great, because it means we know something now we didn't know before.
But I think it's not just fear, Guy. It's like, as we say in the book, it's also, you know, if you grow up with the idea of Pluto as a planet, it's just part of your thought world. It's not just that you're afraid for it to change. It's just that's a pretty serious rearrangement of your mental furniture. Similar, and on a much greater scale, like what happened with Galileo. If the church has grown up with the idea of the Earth being at the center, it's a pretty big change of categories to change that. You got to go with the truth, but it's hard to make those changes, and that stuff's deep in your heart.
And Go ahead.
Yeah, I think the point that Paul's making is that those of us who are forcing the change have to be a little more accommodating to the people for whom the change is a hard change to make.
Make it easier for them, yeah.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. You don't address this in the book that I remember anyway, but the idea of miracles that's, you know, part of a fundamental of faith, that miracles happen, that they're real, and they do qualify as miracles. And I'd like to ask you to sort of generally talk about miracles as whether or not they are actual miracles or that's some kind of a scientific phenomena that we just haven't figured out how it works yet.
We talk about that actually in the Star of Bethlehem chapter, and
okay.
Paul had a wonderful insight into that about, you know, miracles versus science. Let Paul handle it.
Yeah, I just, from my point of view, the tricky thing is in the modern world we tend to think of miracles, we tend to define miracles as being some kind of violation of the laws of science. That's what makes a miracle a miracle. And that's just not what a miracle is, I think, from the point of faith. I mean, scientific laws, as we know them, didn't exist more than 400 years ago. The whole notion of a law of science came to be 400 or 500 years ago. Miracles in the Bible aren't about violating science. They're about giving a sign of the kingdom of God. That's what a miracle is, from my point of view, from the point of view of faith. It's about giving some great sign of the kingdom of God. Whether it happens to involve a violation of a law of science, that's a secondary question. It's not what defines a miracle as a miracle.
I mean, the church does investigate things that it wants to find out if it qualifies as a miracle, right?
It does, but I think the main thing it's doing is trying to use science to eliminate the possibility of fraud. I don't think it's ever the case that science is somehow determining whether a miracle occurred. That's not a scientific question. That's a question of what kind of sign is given. But science is useful in terms of eliminating the possibility that some kind of fraud or mistake has happened.
And it doesn't even have to be a bit of fraud and intentional trying to deceive yourself, but people who are taking what are in fact natural events and trying to overinterpret them, because that's a human temptation as well.
Well, I know that one pretty well. We get, you know, UFO stories that we chase, and there's 95% of them are prosaic explanations right off the bat. It's the other 5% that get interesting.
Exactly.
An example we give in the book, and this is from Guy, is that the great miracle in the Bible of the rainbow as the sign of the covenant for Noah. Well, there's nothing vaguely mysterious scientifically for us now about a rainbow, but that rainbow functioned in the Bible as a great and mysterious and miraculous sign. Doesn't have to be a violation of a law of science to be a miracle.
And I guess Paul gives a wonderful example of, say, your Uncle Charlie hates cats, and one day you see him petting a cat, and he's all going googly eyes over this kitten. You know that there's something changed in Uncle Charlie. You know, maybe he's got a new girlfriend who loves cats, or maybe he's had a stroke, who knows. But the point is, there's nothing mysterious or miraculous about a guy petting a cat, but it's a sign in this particular case of this particular person that something important and different has changed in him.
I would think that anybody who has anything like Vatican on their business card, or anybody can read it in your resume, would be open to questions, or would be peppered with questions about exorcisms. Well, you must know the secret exorcist from the Vatican. Do you get that?
I don't. I know people who do. There was a wonderful Jesuit friend of both of ours, Mitch Pacwa, who for many years was in Chicago. And he would get these questions all the time, and he knew the way to talk to the people who had the questions and the way to treat them seriously, because whether they are possessions or psychological problems, the issue and the person in distress is a real person, and that has to be dealt with.
And do you look at them in the same way as these other questions? When the idea of possession comes up, you're looking for what would be a prosaic, a scientific explanation for what's happening to the person, mental illness or some kind of environmental contamination or some other explanation along those lines? Or are you open to the possibility that there's something else going on?
Well, I think the first thing, as Guy says, is to give good care to the person. That's more important than figuring out is there something weird that violates science going on? I pray. I relate to God every day. That's part of my life. Do I see that as being something contrary to science? No. And I would put some kind of demonic possession. Well, that's a case of something's gone way south in prayer. Something is not working very well, and the relationship needs to be restored somehow. To me, the question of whether that somehow violates science doesn't even come up. It's just a matter of how is the heart relating in love or how has the heart been deformed somehow? And maybe Guy's got another take on that.
Well, I'm just remembering of the great words of Dumbledore at the in the last Harry Potter book when, you know, Harry Potter asks him, is this real or is it all in my mind? And Dumbledore says, well, of course it's in your mind, but why do you think that means it's not real?
Let me ask you sort of an odd, off-the-wall question about whether you guys are optimists or not about the future humans, the human situation. I mean, you look at runaway technology and different ways it's going, possibility of artificial intelligence, climate change, this mass surveillance, at least in this country, mass surveillance, a lot of dark stuff on the horizon. Are you, as scientists, optimistic? Are you, as men of faith, optimistic about where humanity is heading? Guy?
Well, I'll take it as somebody who's in his 60s and having seen a little bit of the world and who's, I'm very close to my parents who are both in their 90s. And as I, you know, bring up some issue in the world that scares me, my dad looks at me and says, I've seen it all before. Trust me, I've seen it all before. When I was a kid, I read a science fiction book called Stand on Zanzibar, and it was written in the late 60s, and it predicted the world of 2010. And it was a terrible dystopia. It was an awful world. Well, the year 2010 came up, and I read the book again. He got an awful lot of it right, and yet it wasn't as bad a world as he described. To remind you, in a religious term, we lost paradise. We're not going to get paradise in this world. There will always be sin. There will always be crises. There will always be war. There's always going to be earthquakes. But there's also always going to be a chance to be a good person, to do good things, and to be with people doing good things in the light of the evil around us.
I'll come at it by challenging a little bit that word optimism, or I guess I'll say it this way. I think I am pessimistic about the future, but also deeply hopeful. I want to distinguish those. I think we humans have an amazing capacity to screw things up. We have an amazing capacity to take the good science we do and use it in bad ways. And that makes me feel pessimistic about the future, except for the fact that I live in the hope of the gospel. I think God is the source of the hope which overcomes our tendency to screw things up and which redeems our tendency to screw things up. So I am at the same time pessimistic and deeply hopeful.
You know, Guy, you're the science fiction reader and fan. I read a lot about the singularity. And there are folks now talking about singularity as something that could happen in my lifetime, where we take the next step into evolving into machines. We can live forever, but we'll be something else. That can't be. I'm not optimistic about that part of it.
And again, I'm much more of a cynic. I know the guy, there's one of the big gurus of that is a fellow named Yudzinski, and I know his family. I know the people who have done artificial intelligence. I was hung out at the artificial intelligence lab at MIT in the 60s and the 70s. And at the end of the day, I think there's so much more to being a human than mere complexity. There's so much more to human intelligence than the chemicals that go on in our brain, although the chemicals that go on show that what's going on is real. So I'll just give one example of that. As a Jesuit, I was asked to work in a sheltered workshop for severely mentally retarded men. And these are men who could not count to three. You know, computers can count marvelously. And yet these are also men who could speak perfect English without worrying about all the bits of grammar that still confuse computers. Computers are not the same as human consciousness. It's the best analogy we've got at the moment. But you know, 100 years ago, Freud was trying to figure out that human beings were like steam engines, because that was the most complicated thing he had to use as an analogy. It's where we are, it's how we make progress, but we got a long way to go.
I just think of, you know, the first guy who can hook his body up to a computer and have a computer part of his brain or attached to it, he'll do it. And then other people will do it because they'll need to compete. I tell you what, George Harrison is telling us we need to take a break. When we come back, we'll be opening up the phone lines with your questions for my guests, the authors of Would You Baptize an Extraterrestrial? My Sweet Lord from 1970 takes us into the break.